Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The Nick Reiner case took a dramatic turn in the last days when high-profile defense attorney Alan Jackson, fresh off his Karen Reid acquittal, withdrew from representing Nick at what was supposed to be his arraignment. Jackson said he was legally and ethically prohibited from explaining why, citing circumstances beyond our control and, more importantly, beyond Nick's control. But then he walked outside the courthouse and told reporters, pursuant to the law in California, Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. Print that! Take that to the bank! Nick is now represented by Deputy Public Defender Kimberly Green. Arraignment has been pushed now to February 23rd, and there's a sealed medical order that sources say relates to his mental health treatment. He's charged with two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, multiple murders with use of a deadly weapon, which means the DA can seek the death penalty or life without parole. In this conviction, I want to break down what's actually happening now legally and what the road ahead looks like. To help us do that, Eric Faddis is with us, defense attorney and former prosecutor. Eric, welcome. Let's start with Alan Jackson's withdrawal. He said he was legally and ethically prohibited from explaining why, but then walked outside to more cameras and declared Nick Reiner not guilty of murder under California law. What sort of circumstances would force a high-profile attorney to withdraw from a case while simultaneously continuing to make public declarations about it? What does it tell you about where this this case is headed, where this defense is headed?
So there are a number of potential reasons why an attorney would have to legally and ethically withdraw. You know, when you're meeting with your client, you're receiving information from them, and that is confidential and it's privileged, and you can't publicly disclose that. So if the basis for his action to withdraw is statements he received from Nick, then yeah, he can't disclose those. Now what are those bases? It could be a money thing. It could be that Nick and or whoever was going to pay for this can't or won't. Another possible option is that Alan Jackson is a high-profile attorney. He may have represented one of the witnesses in the case, a high-profile Hollywood witness, and that could make him legally conflicted in the sense that he couldn't continue with representation. Lastly, another potential basis, I don't know if that's what's going on here, but if the client wants to proceed in a course of action that is either unlawful or unethical or otherwise deceptive, the attorney can make a choice to withdraw and would not be able to disclose the details of the grounds for that withdrawal.
You think that's the something happened was maybe there was a conflict that of all of the Hollywood people, there's a connection sitting there?
Certainly could be. And you know, for example, if Alan Jackson just hypothetically had represented one of these Hollywood folks, got information from that person, and now he's on Nick's case, and he would have to try to take measures that were adverse to the person whom he formerly represented, that could give rise to an ethical conflict whereby he would have to withdraw in part due to his prior loyalty regarding that prior representation.
How interesting. And there's so many possibilities here. The easy one that everybody's jumping to is it's money, Alan Jackson and Kit Pitt. It may very well be that. Let me ask you about logistics on this a little bit, because I think a lot of people are wondering. You would think, at least, that maybe at some point at the beginning here, there was some sort of agreement of money, some sort of promise, wouldn't you? Or was this something where they reached out to him, meaning the family of Nick Reiner reached out and, thinking, oh, let's get the best attorney possible. And then they thought, well, this is going to cost more and more and more. And do we really want to spend all that money? I guess the question is did Alan Jackson, was there money up front in something like this when you're retaining an attorney? Or was this kind of a Nick Reiner IOU? Like, okay, you get going. There's going to be enough money here. We're going to, worst case scenario, we get stiffed on the bill. We got 3 weeks of attention and publicity that's far beyond anything they're going to ever pay us in terms of value. What do you think could have happened there? What I guess legally could have happened there? Money-wise, for him to have done the amount of work that he did, would he have done that for free on an IOU? Or could it be as simple as, here's $5, this is the retainer for now, we'll come to collect later, and hopefully we'll get it?
Yeah, there are a number of options when it comes to how an attorney can have a financial agreement with a client. So mm-hmm. Could be that they had an agreement up front and it was going to be for $1 million. And there had to be installment payments over time because they couldn't front the million. And then when the time came to make an installment payment, that the guarantor or whoever was going to pay for this couldn't make it, at which point that would cause problems for that representation. Alternatively, sometimes attorneys will sort of be retained for a limited purpose, for a limitation in the scope of that representation, which could be the initial phase. Hey, I'm going to go talk with this client. I'm going to assess what the defenses might be. I'm going to tell you what legal strategies I think might work. And then from there, you can decide, client, if you want me to continue representing you. That one is a little more risky because sometimes the judges won't let you withdraw under those circumstances.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of kind of IOUs and contingencies and different aspects that can enter into what that financial arrangement looks like with that client.
I'm kind of wondering about that because, once you're on as the attorney, and he requested to be withdrawn and he was honored at the beginning of a case, it can be a little more, probably more leniency for that sort of thing to take place. But you are kind of rolling the dice there. If you're going to get on with somebody and go 3 weeks down the road and send out these subpoenas and all this, you are risking the judge saying, we don't really care if you're not getting paid. You're on this case. We've seen it in other cases where mm-hmm. people have tried to withdraw and the judge is like, tough shit. you're on it. I would imagine, does the judge go into the chambers and have a conversation with the attorney and hear him out why he's withdrawing as to whether it's a valid reason or not? And does money always translate to the acceptable reason as to why that they should be allowed to withdraw? Or does withdrawal come more so on some of those other circumstances, like you cited, possibly maybe there's a conflict of interest with another person that he may have had some sort of relationship or represented in the past?
There's kind of a unique legal process when an attorney wants to withdraw, because typically everything has to be in open court and everything has to be out in the open and you disclose reasons in front of the prosecutor and everybody else. But when it comes to attorney withdrawals, that's kind of the exception. There can be an ex parte meeting between only the judge, the defense attorney, and the defendant, because there are confidential communications that might be at issue that the prosecutor should not be privy to. So sometimes, there is this kind of like, I don't want to say secret meeting, but private meeting where the defense attorney tells the judge, hey, this is really what's going on, man, and this is the reason I need off of this. But like you said, sometimes judges will say, hey, financial reasons alone are not sufficient to allow an attorney to withdraw. You entered your appearance on this case. This guy needs an attorney. It's a murder case. Sorry, bro, you're on it. The fact that the judge let him off could, I'm not saying it does, but could signal that there are reasons beyond merely the financial that are at play.
Sure. Yeah, lots of possibilities there. Nick appeared at his first hearing in that suicide prevention smock. Wasn't medically cleared to be transported initially, then was. Reports say his medications still are not stabilized. I guess I'm wondering, because this case has drawn so many emotions from so many people, and emotions don't necessarily equal fact or reality. Emotions tend to be emotions and don't necessarily translate into solid fact in most cases. How much of this could be theater that we're looking at right now from the part of Nick Reiner, meaning he's got the suicide smock on, meaning he's the story is, you know, he's not able to participate in his own defense because he thinks there's a conspiracy against him. I mean, it's a lot of things you can say out loud. It's certain ways you can dress up your defendant. There's certain ways of making this look a certain way. And if they play a certain role, they act a certain role. I mean, it's theater. Or it could all be completely legit, and he needs that suicide smock on, and he doesn't, and he thinks there's a conspiracy against him. I guess, how much control does an attorney have over the image that their client is portraying when it comes to something like this?
Well, so from the defense perspective, you're putting on a show in there, whether you like it or not. That's part of this. Isn't some sterile type of process that is devoid of humanity. And so, certainly image matters, presentation matters. And, Nick Reiner may have scored some points with how this thing played out with Alan Jackson. What I mean is that in the beginning, most folks looked at this and said, oh, gosh, what a monster. He just stabbed up his two parents. He looks guilty as heck. But now we've got the suicide smock, and we've got this high profile attorney. And although he's not on the case anymore, he did come out publicly and say, hey, Nick Reiner is not guilty under California law. Could it be some overcomplicated, well thought out ruse, in a sense, to where we're going to hire this high profile attorney? He's going to get us all this attention. He's going to say my dude is not guilty, even though I knew I couldn't have him on for the entire case. This is a heck of a way to kind of tee it up and set the stage for what's to come.
At what point does this become tainting the jury pool? I mean, for somebody to be out there making the rounds about this case who actually had his hands in it, are there any ethical concerns for him doing these interviews after having met with him?
I think the attorney has to be careful about not disclosing privileged and confidential communications that he received from Nick. That being said, attorneys have a First Amendment right. It's limited, but they have a right to kind of say how they feel about a case. And it's a different requirement for defense attorneys than prosecutors. Prosecutors cannot make inflammatory, prejudicial statements to the public, because the concern is that those folks could be jurors and they could be tainted by that information. That concern is not as weighty on the defense side. And you usually don't see a prosecutor saying, hey, tell this defense attorney to stop telling the public stuff. Although when you do, usually the prosecutor seeks a gag order that could prevent the attorney from doing that. But I'm not aware of any gag order in this case.
No, I mean, maybe we didn't even get that far with Alan Jackson yet. You know, I mean, maybe that would have come down the road. Obviously, he's one who doesn't shy away from cameras, does interviews. He has a track record of doing interviews on camera with clients in active cases.
Yes.
It's just kind of his way. It's what he does, and it seems to work well for him. So, I mean, who knows where this could have gone? It's an interesting thought, though, on strategy of like, well, maybe we're not going to use him all the way through, but let's tee it up. Let's get the golden tee out here and go ahead and hit this ball out and see where it goes. And we'll pick it up from there with the golf cart, which is the public defender. I don't know. It's there's so many ways this could have gone. The DA, Nathan Hochman, saying he's fully confident in a conviction, has not ruled out the death penalty, though he's indicated that he'd consider the family's wishes. The surviving siblings reportedly have signaled that they're not in favor of the death penalty, which is not surprising. I would imagine they're probably sick to death of having this character destroying their lives as he has his basic entire existence. and probably want to move on and stop having him being held up and coddled the way his parents did. They're not going to play that role anymore. How much of a role does their opinion play then in the possibility of a death penalty in a case like this? Number one, I think it probably won't happen because of the mental defect issues, but let's just say that's not part of this case. Let's say that he's going to decide this. He's weighing it on what the state would want versus what the surviving family members, the brother and the sister of Nick Reiner want. How much weight does each of these things play?
So in most states, and I'm sure they have this in California, there is something called the Victims' Rights Act or something tantamount to that. What it essentially says is the prosecutor has to consult with the victim's family and has to hear them out and take into consideration their position. But those acts are really without teeth because the prosecutor can just say, hey, yeah, I heard from the victim's family. They want X, but I think Y is more appropriate, so I'm going to go with Y. There's really no way to enforce or determinatively assert the victim's family's interests and what they want to happen if the prosecutor disagrees. So ultimately, the prosecutor is at the helm there, and they can give lip service to the family, but then kind of do what they want.
Yeah, the track record that we have seen with Hockman, I shouldn't say track record. I should say one sole example because I don't have examples of other cases. But the one I can cite that we know he did not take into consideration the family's wishes would be one of the first cases that he had taken up, the Menendez brothers, right away. They were on a fast track to possibly getting their freedom, and Hockman got in power and said nope. Even though pretty much every family member was saying, we think it's time, the boys have suffered enough, he strongly disagreed with that. Ultimately, the parole board took his side, and the Menendez brothers are still in prison with no clear path on the way out. It's not to say that this is going to be indicative of that sort of decision, but it shows us a little bit that he doesn't always necessarily follow what a family wants in a case.
Oh, exactly. And to sort of add to the drama for those Menendez family members, the district attorney before Hockman had sided with the family. And essentially said, hey, I agree with you guys. I think the Menendez brothers should be out. I think your family members should be out. I'm going to give effect to your position, to your interest, to what you want to happen in this case. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it. Let's move forward. Hockman gets in office and completely flips the script and does a 180. I can't imagine what's going on in those family members' minds where they thought, oh my gosh, after decades, my family members are going to be out. The DA even said so. He's on our side. And now, boom, everything changed.
It's amazing.
I can't imagine that roller coaster that the family members are on. That's just, it's sad and tragic. I mean, they had their hopes up, and then it just got the rug pulled out from underneath them.
As the world turns.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. Here now, Tony Brewski.
Where are things at? Where are they going? Where have we been? What's coming to a theater near you for the feature presentation? I mean, that's kind of where we're at in the Nick Reiner case, trying to figure out what's the next step in this combobulation of chaos that has been this case since the tragedy took place in December. Let's go through where things are at right now and kind of get you caught up to speed on all of it. And while we do, continue the conversation in our comment section on our YouTube channel. If you're not there already, Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. You can join in our conversation there. Or our Substack channel. The link is in the description. It's on the screen right now on YouTube. It's hiddenkillers.substack.com. And by the way, it's free to join right now. No ads, no paywall. You just join and you can communicate directly with me. So let's continue our conversation on there as we go through this off the air. January 7th, 2026, big day in this case. Los Angeles Superior Court, it was supposed to be Nick Reiner's arraignment, the moment he'd stand before a judge and enter his plea for allegedly stabbing his parents to death in their Brentwood home. And Alan Jackson, as we all know, walked into that courtroom as Nick Reiner's attorney, one of the most prominent defense lawyers in the country, the man who just secured the murder acquittal in the Karen Reed case, one of the most watched trials in recent memory, the man who represented Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey. He walked in ready to fight, and then he asked to be removed from the case. But here's the thing. Before he left, before he handed Nick Reiner over to the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office, and we'll get to that in a second, Alan Jackson walked outside that courthouse, stood in front of every camera in Los Angeles, and said something that should make everyone pay attention. Quote, "We've investigated this matter top to bottom, back to front. What we've learned, and you can take this to the bank, is that pursuant to the law of this state, pursuant to the law in California, Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder." Print that! He's always so dramatic. This isn't an attorney hedging his bets. This isn't "my client deserves his day in court" or "everyone is entitled to a defense." That's a declaration. This is a man who wins high-profile cases telling the entire world that he knows something they don't. So what the hell happened in that courtroom? And what does Alan Jackson know that we don't? Or has he really just connected the dots the same way that we've been connecting the dots over here on technicalities? And here's how this would play out if you're to go down this path and run it through what California deems an insanity defense. Let's start with what Alan Jackson said about why he withdrew. He told reporters it was due to circumstances beyond our control, but more importantly, circumstances beyond Nick's control. He added that he was legally and ethically prohibited from explaining the reasons why. And I get it. Legally and ethically prohibited. That's not a throwaway line. That's an attorney choosing his words very carefully because he knows the rules he's operating under. Attorney-client privilege, court orders, professional ethics. Something is preventing him from telling us more. And whatever it is, it's apparently binding enough that one of the most media-savvy lawyers in America won't touch it. But here's what's interesting. Jackson didn't just withdraw and disappear. He didn't issue a bland statement and walk away. He emphasized that his team remains deeply committed to Nick Reiner and his best interests. I found that one interesting too. I don't know if that's just lawyerese for "have a nice day. We wish you the best. Thoughts and prayers." Good luck. And, you know, we're deeply committed to Nick Reiner and his bet. Yeah, I mean, you can be deeply committed to something and not actually be an active participant in it. Yeah, that, you know, a lot of people are like that in lives. Or is there more? I don't know. I mean, you don't say that if you're not abandoning a client you think is guilty. You don't say that if you're walking away because the case is unwinnable. You say that if something procedural, something outside the facts of the case itself is forcing your hand. And then you walk outside and tell everyone your client is not guilty of murder under California law, take it to the bank. Jackson signed on to represent Nick Reiner the day after his arrest. That was December 15th. He withdrew January 7th. 3 weeks. 3 weeks is a lot of time. It's enough to find something significant. And Nick's first court appearance in December, Jackson told reporters they were very complex and serious issues associated with this case, issues that needed to be thoroughly and very carefully dealt with and examined and looked at and analyzed. He wasn't specific, and he really couldn't be, but he was signaling that his case wasn't as straightforward as it looked. Before he withdrew, Jackson told the court there were 10 outstanding subpoenas in the defense's investigation. 10. And the judge sealed the list. The prosecution doesn't even know who the defense was trying to reach. I know that. I mean, whatever witness or records Jackson was chasing, he convinced a judge they needed to be kept secret, even from the DA's office. That's not standard procedure. That's kind of strategic. That's a defense team protecting something that they found. So what kind of subpoenas would you need for an insanity defense? Medical records from the medication change that reportedly happened about a month before the killings, psychiatric evaluations, treatment facility records from those reported 18-plus rehab stays, witnesses from Conan O'Brien's holiday party who allegedly saw Nick acting erratically the night before, people who interacted with him in the days and weeks leading up to December 14th, anyone who could speak to his mental state? Those kind of subpoenas? Jackson found something in those 3 weeks, something in those records or those witness statements or those medical files, something that made him confident enough to stand on courthouse steps and declare Nick Reiner not guilty of murder. And this is where most people get confused. So let's be clear about what Jackson said and what he didn't say. He did not say Nick Reiner didn't kill his parents. He did not claim innocence. He did not suggest there was a wrongful arrest or a case of mistaken identity. He said Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder under California law. Those are two completely different statements. An insanity defense doesn't argue my client didn't do it. It argues my client did it, but the law says he's not criminally responsible because his mental state at the time of the crime prevented him from understanding what he was doing or knowing that it was wrong. That's the McNaughton rule. That's the standard in California. Did the defendant understand the nature and quality of their actions? Did they know those actions were wrong? Sources say Nick reportedly admits he killed his parents. He allegedly is not claiming memory loss or that someone else did it, but he also reportedly believes his incarceration is part of the conspiracy against him. That's not someone saying, I didn't do it. That's someone whose brain reportedly isn't processing reality correctly. That's someone who may have committed an act without understanding, legally speaking, what that act actually was. And we can get into the minutiae of it. There's a whole other video I just did. Just go back in our feed a little bit or on a podcast on audio where we really get into the details of the McNaughton rule, what it means, and the standard and all of that. It goes back to the 1800s. It's an almost 200-year-old doctrine. Yeah, it's like 180-some years old. Very few states still hold it. Canada still holds it. California still holds it. There's a few others that do, too. It's essentially part of the rules in that state where, you know, you could pull off this defense there, travel 700 miles in another direction to another state. You couldn't, because they wouldn't have that same set of rules. Essentially, I mean, view it as a game, if you will. And obviously, this is not a game. I'm not trying to downplay it, but think of a board game. You get the rules out. You can't play Candyland by Monopoly rules. You can't play Monopoly by Candyland rules. One of them has these rules. One of them has those rules. It's like states. They all have a different set of rules. What you can do in one, you can't necessarily do in the other. Does it change morally, ethically, anything about the crime? No, it's all about interpretation. And it's an interpretation by a state, not a human. But the humans are charged with interpreting those states' rules. So that's what's going on. Okay? I know it's really easy to get caught up in the, well, asshole, this, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, okay, whatever. I mean, you can make your judgments on all that, but that's not what's going on. He's following the rules. That's what the attorneys do. They have to play by the rules. They're looking at them. They're deciphering them. They're interpreting them. And according to Jackson, play it through that filter. That's how it comes out on the other end. And you know what? He might be completely right. Jackson's declaration wasn't about innocence. It was about criminal responsibility. And apparently, he found enough evidence to convince himself that Nick Reiner doesn't meet the legal threshold for murder. Not because Nick didn't kill his parents, but because Nick's mind allegedly was incapable of forming the intent that the law requires. There's another piece of this that's been largely overlooked. A sealed confidential medical order was signed by the judge overseeing Nick Reiner's case. Sources say it relates to the mental health condition and treatment. NBC4 reported that three sources with direct knowledge of the case confirmed Nick was being treated for schizophrenia at the time of the murders. That's a separate form, or perhaps a clarification of the schizoaffective disorder diagnosis that's been reported elsewhere. Either way, we're talking about a serious psychiatric disorder, the kind that causes delusions and hallucinations, the kind that fundamentally alters how someone perceives reality. What could be in that sealed order? Findings about Nick's mental state from jail psychiatrists, evaluations conducted since his arrest, orders related to medication and treatment, maybe something about the medication change that reportedly happened before the killings, the one that sources say sent him into the spiral. The judge sealed it for a reason, to protect the defense strategy, to prevent tainting the jury pool, to maintain medical privacy, but also, and this is the part that matters, because whatever's in there is significant enough that everyone agreed it needed to be kept out of public view. Alan Jackson saw what was in that order. He knows what the psychiatric evaluations say. And then he walked outside and told us Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. The obvious theory for Jackson's withdrawal is money. And look, it is not crazy. He's not confirmed nor denied that. Alan Jackson doesn't come cheap. Legal experts estimate a retainer in a case like this is about seven figures. Taking it to trial, well north of $1 million. Someone has to pay that bill. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. He's worked his way up as one of the most effective and best defense attorneys in the nation. It comes with a price tag. He can command that. That's how our system works. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. It is what it is. But if you don't have the money to pay that, then you're not going to get him as your attorney. He doesn't operate on good vibes. Nick Reiner reportedly lived in his parents' guest house. He was allegedly receiving $10,000 monthly allowance from them. According to reports, he wasn't independently wealthy. He wasn't funding his own defense. And here's the brutal irony. Under California's Slayer statute, if you kill someone, you can't inherit from them. Nick allegedly killed both of his parents, which means he can't touch a dime of their estate. The money that reportedly kept him afloat his entire adult life, the money that allegedly paid for rehab after rehab, 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 and 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 his lifestyle, that would have eventually come to him. That money is now legally off limits. So, who was paying Alan Jackson? Likely the family. Again, this is all pure conjecture and speculation and opinion and allegedly and everything else that goes along with it. Who was likely paying Alan Jackson? The family, the siblings, the estate, someone with access to the Reiner money. Again, speculation. And apparently, that someone stopped. But here's the problem with that theory. Jackson specifically said the circumstances were beyond Nick's control. Nick never controlled the money. His parents did. Now his siblings do. If the family cut off funding, is that beyond Nick's control? I would probably say, yeah. More importantly, why make the not guilty declaration if you're just getting stiffed on the bill? You don't stake your professional reputation on a client you're abandoning over fees. You don't tell the world to print that and take it to the bank if you're walking away bitter about unpaid invoices. I don't think he's bitter about unpaid invoices at all. We don't know that that even is an issue here. We don't know what sort of money changed hands, if anything. But money might be part of the story. But it's not the whole story. Something else forced Jackson's hand, something he can't talk about, something that has nothing to do with whether he believes in Nick Reiner's defense, because he clearly still does. Deputy Public Defender Kimberly Green is now representing Nick Reiner. I know what people are thinking. Public defender, that's a downgrade. That's a death sentence for his case. Not necessarily. The Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office handles death penalty cases regularly. They have resources. They have investigators. They have access to expert witnesses. They do this work every day, and they actually have a better track record than private attorneys in death penalty cases. So if you're facing the death penalty in California, your odds of getting off or a lesser sentence actually lie with a public defender, not Alan Jackson. Interesting, I know. Although if it is, we're playing odds here, and Alan Jackson is kind of an outlier in the odds game. He's the diamond in the rough, where it's like, if you get him, your odds probably go way up as compared to the averages of all of the private attorneys that are out there that you could hire. I'm not saying anything bad about them, but if you're a public defender, you work these type of cases statistically more frequently than most private attorneys would. Just statistically, you do. So if we're playing those, we're going by laws of averages here, and at the end of the day, nothing is an average. Everything's a unique situation. But if we're doing that, then your odds increase because they have more reps. You have a better opportunity if you don't have resources of going with that public defender than necessarily the private one. I know. An insanity defense is an insanity defense. The evidence is the evidence. The psychiatric evaluations say what they say. The medical records show what they show. A public defender can present that evidence just as effectively as a private attorney. But there's a transition problem. Jackson spent 3 weeks investigating. He had subpoenas out. He knew where to look and who to talk to. Does Green inherit all that work? Does she have access to what Jackson found, or does she start from scratch? Continuity matters in a case this complex, especially when the defendant's mental state is the entire ballgame. Maybe Jackson's courthouse statement was strategic. Maybe he wanted to put on the public record what was investigated, or what his investigation revealed, so it doesn't get lost in the handoff. So everyone knows what direction this defense was heading. So the new attorney has a roadmap, even if she doesn't have the file. Meanwhile, the prosecution isn't backing down. DA Nathan Hotchman issued his own statement after Jackson withdrew. Quote, "We are fully confident that a jury will convict Nick Reiner beyond a reasonable doubt for the brutal murder of his parents, Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner, and do so unanimously." Notice the language, brutal murder. Not neutral. That's the prosecutor framing this case for the public before it even gets to trial, because it was a brutal murder. The problem is, can you show that Nick Reiner understood the depths of what he was actually doing when he did it, if he did it? The charges are serious. 2 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, multiple murders, and use of a deadly weapon. That means the death penalty is on the table. Hotchman says he'll consider the family's wishes before deciding whether to pursue it, and the surviving siblings have reportedly indicated they're not in favor. But he hasn't ruled it out. The decision ultimately lands with him. Considering California has not put anyone to death in decades, although it is still a penalty and people are still sentenced to it, doesn't mean it's actually ever going to happen. But it could. And if you're going to keep that on the table, it just made your trial that much more complex, because then you have to have death penalty qualified attorneys. It's going to take more time. There's more leniency. There's more grace to take your time to make sure the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, because you don't want that done the opposite way in a death penalty case. if expedition of this case is in anyone's interest, if Nick Reiner wants this to go in any sort of speedy direction, it being a death penalty case is not the way you want it to go. It's going to take longer. And it should. Someone's life is on the line. Will the prosecution go there? In my opinion, I'm going to guess no. I'm going to guess they might go with what the Reiners probably want. Life behind bars or life in an institution. That's my prediction and conjecture. The prosecution has evidence. They have the gas station surveillance video showing Nick calmly buying a drink hours after the killings. They'll frame that as consciousness of guilt. He fled the scene. He knew what he did. He was composed enough to stop for a Gatorade before getting arrested. But Jackson clearly isn't worried about that video. He saw the same footage everyone else saw, and he still walked outside and declared Nick not guilty of murder. Two experienced legal minds looking at the same facts. One says conviction is certain. One says take it to the bank. He's not guilty. One of them is wrong. The question is which one? So why did Alan Jackson find in 3 weeks, or what did he find in 3 weeks, that made him so certain? What's in those medical records? What did the psychiatric evaluations reveal? What did witnesses from that party tell his investigators? What's in that sealed order that the judge doesn't want anyone to see? We don't know. We can't know. Not yet. He told the world to take it to the bank. That means there's cards he's holding that he thinks are winners, unless it's a bluff. The question is whether those cards transfer to a public defender, whether Kimberly Green can pick up where Jackson left off, or whether the defense he was building survives the handoff, or whether it stays locked in Alan Jackson's briefcase, legally and ethically permitted, prohibited from being shared. I do not know the answer to that question. I would guess, based on what we've seen from Alan Jackson and him stating to the effect that, he cares about this case, he cares about the interest of Nick Reiner, I don't see any reason why that information wouldn't be shared with the new counsel. Again, my conjecture. Nick Reiner's arraignment has been pushed out to February 23rd. As of the most recent reports, his medications still aren't stabilized. The question of whether he's even competent to stand trial, whether he understands the proceedings and can participate in his own defense, hasn't been resolved. We might be months away from that determination, maybe longer. There's a lot of cases where it comes and it goes, and it comes and it goes. This case could exist in legal limbo for years. Competency hearings, psychiatric evaluations, medication adjustments, more hearings, the ping pong that happens when someone's brain won't cooperate with the legal system's timeline. Meanwhile, Rob and Michelle Reiner are dead. Stabbed to death in their own home, allegedly by the son they spent nearly two decades trying to save. Their surviving children are grieving. The entertainment industry is mourning. And Nick Reiner sits in a jail cell, reportedly believing his incarceration is a conspiracy against him. Alan Jackson says Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. The DA says he's fully confident in a conviction. Somewhere between those two statements is the truth. And right now, the only person who seems to know what that truth looks like is a defense attorney who just walked off the case, but not before making damn sure everyone heard what he had to say. Take it to the bank. Print that. The question isn't whether Nick Reiner killed his parents. The question is what California law says about a mind that's broken enough to do it. Alan Jackson spent 3 weeks finding his answers. Now it's up to someone else to prove it. Where do you think it's going? Give me your thoughts in the comments section. Let's continue this off the air. I'll be watching for your thoughts on YouTube and on our Substack, where you can communicate directly with me Check it out. It's absolutely free right now for a limited time. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is on your screen if you're watching us on YouTube right now. It's also in the description of this episode. Please join us over there, and you'll get access to our videos a day in advance of everyone else, too. Ad-free, and ready for you to weigh in on. So please do check us out there on Substack and press subscribe wherever it is you're listening to us or watching us. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts as well. If that's your platform of choice, we do greatly appreciate it. Helps signal to others that you're appreciating this reporting, you're finding it valuable, and it helps us grow. So thank you in advance for taking some time to do that if you have not done so already. And if you have, thank you. Really, really do appreciate that. All right, let's continue this off the air. I'll be watching for your comments. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.